First they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world.
Health and biotech news, a tech bro or sis would find kind of interesting.
We are here to celebrate the completion of the first survey.
On the advice of counsel, I will not be giving an opening statement.
Of the entire human genome.
Okay guys, so Get Harley, the skincare telehealth company, has just raised a monster $52 million round led by Index Ventures. So Imran, why is their business model so interesting?
Well, so I was thinking about this, and this is an unusual round. I'm going to answer your question in a sec, but I just want to say this is an unusual round because in the current climate, from my point of view, there's still quite a lot of investment happening in the early stages. But to see a $50 million direct-to-consumer UK-based Series B round is like a bit eccentric in this current environment. It's a big round. And we don't actually have such a great track record of like direct-to-consumer healthcare companies raising this much at this stage with a UK focus. So the reason I think this business model is interesting is that for most physicians, unless you like own the practice and it's a private practice and you own the building, you own the service, is that you get paid for doing work. You get paid for seeing patients. So if you think about a private surgeon or a private physician, they'll have a room on Harley Street or in a private hospital, they'll have a contract, they'll do clinics, they'll see patients, and they'll get basically paid by volume. And they might get paid one rate for clinic appointments, they might get paid another rate for procedures. What this company has now done has basically created a recurring revenue model subscription service for these doctors and these clinicians, because they're not all doctors, that are working on the platform. So if you see a patient and you prescribe them a regimen of skin treatments, and they say they have hundreds or thousands of different products, different brands that they can source for patients to create the perfect recipe of personalized skincare. And I do question what the word personalized means in this context, but we can come back to that. As long as the patient is fulfilling like refills, is buying refills of that product, the clinician gets a share of the revenue from the product. And these products, which are sometimes called cosmeceuticals, because they're often for cosmetic or aesthetic purposes, and they may have higher concentrations of certain biologically active compounds, and some of them might be prescription medications, they can have, branded versions can have like an 80% profit margin. So they're very, very high gross margin products that you're basically creating a subscription business around for the patients. And then presumably they'll innovate on how the doctor or the clinician checks in with the patient from time to time. It doesn't always have to be like a face-to-face virtual consultation. Maybe it will be like a email check-in, a survey, an asynchronous consult of some sort, which is incredibly time efficient. So yeah, that's my take on why this is interesting, is that, you know, it turns doctors into generators of recurring revenue, which in the past has been quite unusual. And if you look at telemedicine businesses, usually that has been through subscriptions to a telemedicine service, but here it's actually through product sales. So it's kind of like a recurring e-commerce subscription plus a telemedicine consult upfront.
The most interesting thing about this business model is that it's only $50 for the initial clinician consult, which is 30 minutes long. And if you need to see a more senior dermatologist, an attending or consultant dermatologist, that's $180. So these prices are really peanuts. And I wonder if that these consults are actually loss leaders or at least break even. So they're saying, hey, we're going to lose money on this initial consult. This doctor is going to recommend a load of products. And the real crux or the real part of the real big part of the pie is going to be this monthly recurring fee. Do you think that's fair?
I mean, that's definitely. That's literally the business model of most digital health startups that do like prescriptions. So, you know, if you're going to do a hair loss product or a sexual health product, the initial consultation is actually for free. It's not even, you don't even pay for that because the money is made on the prescriptions.
It's interesting because like, you know, just to give it like a price benchmark, I presume the £150 is for like the experienced consultant dermatologist. So in the private sector, you would pay £250 to £350 for that 30-minute appointment, I think. Yeah, in a place like Harley Street. I mean, there's tiers in the private sector as well.
And Harley Street is like billionaire's row for doctors in London.
Yeah, it's like the fanciest, most exclusive private practice, you know, street in London. So it's synonymous with that scene. So definitely. So £150 is already like a 50% discount, right? So they must be really like building their business case on that area under the curve on the longer term subscriptions. And as we mentioned before, like these products, you could spend 50, 100, 200, £300 on a product. But interestingly, that's per month. Interestingly, these services that they're selling, they don't seem to actually be selling the highest price services that these clinicians offer in their own private practice. So I think where this fits into the scope of the clinician's practice is like where there are non-interventional, non-procedural types of consultations and prescriptions. And because I don't see anything here about like, you know, laser procedures and like fillers, and there's a whole like spectrum of like aesthetic treatments that these same physicians, if you Google them.
There's a good business idea, a subscription for Botox.
Yeah.
How important actually, do you think marketing is here? Because there's not much differentiating all of these teledermatology companies, right? And you even see with their branding here, they're called Get Harley, so referencing Harley Street. As far as I can tell, they don't have any physical presence or any clinic on Harley Street. They've just called themselves that, which is, you know, A-grade marketing. But like, how much do you reckon they're spending on this sort of stuff?
Yeah, I like their branding. Their branding is pretty good. And another kind of clue there as well is in the valuation. I'm pretty sure that they're, I mean, the skincare is a big market, but just by the fact that they're calling themselves Harley might be an indication that they have a future plans to go into different verticals of health.
What do you mean? Do you mean beyond?
They're not
just
naming themselves a skincare company. They're not like Get Harley Skin. They're Get Harley.
Yeah.
And so $50 million. Let's just assume that like the company was priced at a pre-money valuation of somewhere between $150 and $250 million. I would guess. So if fifty million dollars is 20% of the post-money equity, then the company was pre-money was about 200.
So apparently, so prior to now, Get Harley had raised around 15 million in funding. And in the 4 years since their foundation, the company says it has garnered some 100,000 active users and amassed a team of 70.
So 100,000 active users, even if you assume that they're spending £30 a month, that's £3 million a month. So that's like, is that right?
They say 100,000 active users.
So that's like 36 million. So that would be like a... So it's probably less than that. Listen, even if they're at 1 million monthly recurring revenue, they'll be at about... That's 10 to 12 million a year. So it's about 10 to 20x of the annual recurring revenue as their valuation, which is, yeah, I mean, that's not unreasonable. That would be my guess on the kind of valuation of the company and the revenue. I would guess that they're about around a million, probably a bit more than a million MRR.
What do you think stops people from getting the initial consult and then sourcing these medicines from a cheaper place or just somewhere else? Like, what do you think keeps the loyalty?
Yeah, I think their initial approach will be to target people who are happy to pay a premium for the convenience. And then you probably will have that problem with time, but you'll probably just bake that into the churn and work on that.
Yeah, and I wonder, especially with a lot of these products that they are prescription-based, I do wonder how much the average customer is going to bother going out and getting another prescription from somewhere else. That seems like quite a good lock-in they have there.
Yeah, so it's going to be, that will be one part of it. And I'm sure that it's also the kind of the cocktail, the mixing, the kind of like, you know, the je ne sais quoi that goes into like the, you know, pulling together this, you know, expert mix, the personalization, that aspect of it. So let's say, for example, there's a prescription product in your prescription, in your bag, and then there's going to be some additional products to hand to like minimize the redness, the dryness, which is precipitated by a tretinoin or something like that, like an aloe vera. Or so there'll be some mixing going on there, which means that if you just want to replace a like for like, especially if they have like quite a broad product suite, it could be quite difficult for people to find that exact mix. I don't know much about the treatment space, but I suspect there's something there that will keep people anchored. But I think generally loyalty in these types of products is going to be challenging for these businesses, especially if you find out that you're paying more than you could elsewhere. Because if it's a branded product, you can look up the exact same product, you know, online.
One interesting part as well, to go back to the marketing, is Imran, you linked this article that says that Hims and Hers, which is the huge unicorn telehealth company, they spend half of their revenue on marketing. Was that right?
Yeah, so Hims, I think, is instructive because of all of the companies that have gone onto the stock market, you know, who listed in that kind of period, post-COVID period, when there was just like tons of like SPACs hitting the market and tons of startups basically listing. Hims is interesting because it hasn't been totally decimated. So it did go up and then it came down again. I think it sort of, hit a peak of about $25 per share. And now it's about $9, which is close to the $10 it would have listed at. But it's basically held its value and it's done quite well. So I think Hims is like an interesting example to look at. Their quarterly revenue is $190 million. So their annual revenue is somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion. The company's still growing fast. It's almost doubling year on year. Their profit margin, gross profit margin, is 80%, right? So it's like selling software. They're selling, you know, skin products, hair loss products, Viagra, and so on. But it's an 80% gross margin business. The reason that the company is still net losing money, the biggest driver of that, is that 50% of every dollar that they earn is spent on marketing. So then they have other costs as well, like operations costs and investments in their technology and so on, which would actually make them gross negative, but they have quite a lot of cash on their books, which puts them in a good position.
And why do you think they're making that decision? Is it purely that they put in, okay, this is our customer acquisition cost, this is, you know, when we put a dollar of marketing in, this is what we get back? Is it just as simple as that? So let's just...
Yeah, they're just buying growth. They're just buying growth.
I mean, in businesses like this, there's only going to be one or two big players, and they need to be that player.
Yeah, and the product is actually quite sticky. So, and interestingly for Hims, 85% of everybody who signs up on a monthly subscription is still subscribed like 2 years later. And their payback period, which is basically, if you look at the customer acquisition cost, which is the cost averaged out per each customer that becomes a paying customer of yours, it takes 12 months to get that investment back. And then 85% of people are still customers.
Which is actually quite high. That's actually a quite high customer acquisition cost.
Yeah, you mean it's a long, long payback?
Yeah, and 85%, is that year over year?
No, that's at 2 years, 85% retention over 2 years, which is good. 85% retention over 2 years is really good. So I think basically, if the customers become like net profitable after 1 year, or in terms of a LTV to CAC perspective, then it kind of makes sense to keep investing in marketing because...
Sorry, LTV means lifetime value of the customer.
Yeah, the lifetime value of the customer. Basically, with these consumer health companies, a lot of the success and failure of these companies boils down to can you generate, and this you can say is for most businesses, can you generate more money off these customers that you're onboarding than the cost of acquiring that customer, right? And what happened, the reason why this is so important to understand, is that during the COVID crisis and everybody basically going online and searching for online access to treatments and health conditions on the internet, customer acquisition costs, which are a combination of, you know, buying customers with Google ads, Instagram ads, TikTok, advertising in other channels, newsletters, wherever it is people are advertising, those customer acquisition costs generally increase dramatically for a lot of healthcare products. They could double and triple. And I also think because of the iOS 14 changes, which reduced the ability to do like targeted tracking of consumers, has made it even more expensive basically to acquire customers. Those having a handle on those numbers is super important. And also as areas become more competitive, let's say like skin is heating up, let's say like another 3 to 5 companies look at this fundraiser like, oh, there's a huge opportunity in skin, and they start launching in the same product space, a service space, then what will happen is that you'll have more and more competition for the keywords and for the eyeballs of the potential customers. So that drives customer acquisition costs even higher. So in a business like this, really what you want to do ideally, I would imagine, is like find more channels to acquire customers rather than just relying on Google and social media ads. In an ideal world, you know, I think you'd want, there are a few channels you can in theory find which could actually be like zero customer acquisition costs. Let's say you have a partnership with another provider or another company of some kind, and they're channeling their customers towards you. So
what they also have is a big database of people, and they can also sell them different products or move into different verticals. So what they're trying to do, for example, is to have this holistic approach of sexual health, for example, not just being selling Viagra, but also moving these people on to having sexual health checks and getting appointments with doctors, and they can have a piece of that pie as well. Because you have a huge database of people who are interested in some kind of healthcare product. So you're selecting for a really good customer base for a host of other different products as well, not just for these single verticals.
Well, let me ask you two a question then. provided that what we see in Hims and Hers and, you know, spending 50% of their revenue in marketing, say that that's broadly true for the rest of the industry, what does that say about the sector, considering that 50% of revenue is going on arguably a non-productive use? Is that fair to say that, you know, they're not spending on research and development or making things better? They're just essentially
R&D companies. What they do is they wait for medications to go off patent, and then they market the hell out of those medications and make it super easy to get these medications. Not even off patent. They don't have to be off patent, but it's, I mean, Ozempic is a really good example here, right? Once Ozempic became available for weight loss, all of these companies jumped on Ozempic. They just added them to their repertoire and marketed Ozempic for weight loss for all their existing customers.
No, but Adam, my point is that if they have this revenue, is then arguably not more productive uses? I mean, even if they, for example, enhance the, I don't know, the distribution logistics, I don't know, invest in drones or something to deliver these quicker. I mean, are there not more useful things you can be doing rather than running ads?
Well, no, because the
how they grow revenue. They're being valued on...
It's about growth, I think.
They're being valued on the basis of their growth and like how profitable it is.
I understand that that's why they're doing it. I understand their incentives, but I'm just saying that is that not something indicative of the sector, that there's not like innovation going on? There's just this much spend on marketing. Is that not like a red flag, or no? Am I just...
I think we do need to move beyond this model, or I mean, there is going to be a next generation of companies that move beyond this model, this like single, very focused, vertical, easy kind of subscription model, where there needs to be a bit more holistic care involved in these subscriptions, where you get a host of tests and where you're paying actually for not just one single product, you're paying for kind of early checkups and also the treatments and plans that come out of that. So yeah, I think there is going to be a kind of a new generation of companies that take this model to the next step.
Yeah, and Imran, you've mentioned that, you know, arguably, is this really personalized medicine? So in Get Harley's case, I guess they're claiming that they're going to give you a personalized skin routine, which, you know, it's arguable whether this really is personalized or are they just picking products for you? And with so many customers, can they not be running cool randomized controlled trials, you know, giving half one recommendation, the other this recommendation, using color matched, light matched images to see the effect on both? Do you know what I mean? Is there just cooler stuff they can be doing rather than blowing half their money on marketing?
What is it? So you're asking I think you're touching on something that I haven't quite figured out what it is that the underlying dynamic of this type of business is. But basically what you're saying is...
It's basically like just taking a single vertical and just like rinsing it of all value. And not really, arguably not adding, you know what I mean? Not adding a lot. It's like when you see like an ad word and you just buy it and you just link your site on and you just, do you know what I mean? You're just not really, you're just like this middleman. It's not really...
So there's an interesting
conversation. That would be really cool to have like multiple trials going on and then generating some like actual real science. The problem with that is you're selling people a premium product. No one wants to pay a premium price for a placebo, right?
No, but you don't even need the placebo. Trial. Can you just give them two different, you know, products?
I mean, I want the which one is better? Give me the better one. I'm not sure if there is a law as well that prohibits...
What I find confusing about this space is that like a lot of the skin products on the market, if you just put like pharmaceutical products aside for a second, just think about creams and so on. I personally, like the dermatologist friends that I have in my network, and I think you, Musty, might know some as well. My understanding is that they're basically like quite undifferentiated products. So like if you look inside the bottle or you look inside the container at what is actually in the product, vast majority of the ingredients are very similar across products. And there has been relatively little innovation in the space to the extent that we're still talking about tretinoin creams here in 2023, when I learned about them when I worked as a dermatology doctor in 2011, 12.
I bet you that tretinoin is 80% of their prescriptions.
Yeah. So there hasn't been a huge amount of innovation in the space. But despite that, what they're trying to do is, instead of like becoming a kind of commodity race to the bottom, is that they're trying to position it as like a premium service. And the way that they're positioning it is in two ways. One is that if you look at how they present their physicians, they do have like very prestigious physicians on their team. If you Google those same people and look at their private practice pages, it's hard to like get into a room with one of those people without losing like 500 to 1,000 pounds, right? That's how much they charge. All of their procedures, like hundreds or thousands of pounds. Some of them are 2,500 pounds a pop and you need like one every month. They're positioning, they're affiliating like the, you know, their brand with those people. And then they're also selling branded cosmeceuticals, unlike Skin and Me. And presumably now there will be a flurry of like other increasingly, because also the waiting list for all of these services are going up and access to public services are going down because of the backlog and so on. You're going to see other companies coming in and they're going to try and nibble away at the profit margin of businesses like this by undercutting them, underselling them, selling white label generic versions. And it's going to kind of like what you saw in the phase one telemedicine, which we talked about before with the primary care. It was like £30 a month for a Babylon subscription or £50 a month. And you could basically see a doctor almost whenever you wanted. It's a race to the bottom, right? On pricing. So they're trying, I think, to like move away from that. It will be interesting to see how that plays out.
You know, that Scooby-Doo meme where the guy is wearing a mask and it's like, is that you again? Personalized medicine?
Yeah. And like when I think of personalized medicine, like I don't know what, like obviously dermatology is, you know, the state of the art in dermatology clinical practice is like, you know, it's not omics in the personalized medicine. It's not like metabolomic assessment of a skin sample, right?
I mean, is there a place for innovation here? Like how many people have long-term like skin issues or that can't be, you know, for a general population, it's like wear a sunscreen, moisturize, and maybe
But I do think with aesthetic medicine, I think it's like a market creation play, because like if you look back 10, 20, 30 years, like nobody except in very extreme specific circumstances where the plastic surgeon was like having these treatments. What's happened is they've grown the TAM. They've like made everybody a potential customer, right? Maybe I should become a potential customer. Maybe I need it. But the point is that like this market has kind of grown through marketing efforts and innovation in the products, which is basically, I think, making more and more physicians, clinicians, not fully trained, partially trained, even non-clinicians in some cases, able to like apply and deliver these treatments.
Do you guys have any thoughts on other markets you might do this setup in? So if we stray out of dermatology, I mean, if you two were to build something, where might you go in a single vertical? What would be attractive to you?
I know where Adam's going. I mean, he's already building it. He's already building
it.
You haven't plugged your startup yet in this episode, Adam. It's not too late.
I mean, we're looking at skincare and like sexual health and all of this while we're dying from heart disease, metabolic dysfunction, cognitive decline. And we can now prevent these diseases to a large extent with early intervention, with cheap medications. That if started right by for the right people at the right time, we can actually make a dent in these big issues that we're facing. So I think those are big verticals that people are not taking.
Just to abstract Adam's point a little bit. So I think basically anything where you can't get decent treatment through traditional routes. So if you think about longevity, which is the example Adam's giving, absolutely. Like if you go to your GP and you say like, I would like to see you biannually for a longevity assessment and like, you know, have a full workup and like, you know, like track my biomarkers, they'll laugh you out the door. They'll be like, sorry, mate, like that's a great idea. Off you go. You know, we can't do that here. So things which are not managed well within the traditional care system, and skin is an example. I think the backlog to see a dermatologist, there's only like a few hundred dermatologists in the UK, right, for 70, 80 million people. So the backlog to see a dermatologist is really long. And then the dermatologist that you see might be focused on skin cancer, or they might be focused on pediatric dermatology or something. So if you go to them with like a cosmetic aesthetic need, they're probably, unless they're trained in that, they're, you know.
Let me ask our esteemed colleague a question then. So Adam, you built your first startup acquired by 8Sleep, Span Health. That was D2C longevity. And then I think your new startup, Numenor, is again D2C longevity. Am I yes. right there? So I think what's really interesting about, say, what Get Harley have done is, have you heard of this whole like vitamin versus painkiller model in business? So I think what's interesting about Get Harley is that when you're targeting the skin, you're seeing it every day. Everyone's looking at it. You're looking in the mirror. So if you've got some imperfect skin, in your opinion, you are going to spend money to fix it right now. Whereas the whole longevity issue is that you're not seeing the consequences of your actions.
Yeah,
maybe that's why these make good businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually a good point. But I think this is actually changing. I think people are more and more getting frustrated with the lack of focus on prevention from their traditional healthcare providers. And this is what I see every day talking to people and talking to patients, that they want this kind of service and they can't find it.
Out of interest, do you think, because I think you probably, in your longevity side of things, you probably see a certain sliver of the population who are probably the innovators on the adoption curve, right? Like the early majority, at least. Do you think that today, or in the next, say, 5 or 10 years, do you think like there is a space for a venture scale longevity startup? I mean, obviously you're going to say yes, but curious to hear your thoughts.
Yes, but I'm a big believer of you can create a market if you're good enough. And I think a lot of the onus will be on companies to educate people to this stuff. So, for example, you know, someone like Peter Attia, for example, if Peter Attia didn't exist and he never had his podcast, or like Andrew Huberman didn't do his podcast, these people didn't write their books, there will be a significant number of people who have never heard of this stuff, right? So actually, like, exposing people in an easy to understand way to this kind of way of thinking does create new markets.
Do you think, though, that there's almost a part of it where, if you have to educate someone on why your product is useful, then you kind of lost the game already?
No, it just means it's a more difficult business. You're not selling Coke, you're not selling Viagra, where people are knocking down the door to get their hands on this product. It's a difficult business. And if I wasn't passionate about longevity, if this wasn't my life's work, I definitely wouldn't be doing it.
But what would you know, if you were to do something else, what would you do? Like something that you think people would be knocking down the door? You know, if you were to just make a real grift and just, I want to start a startup that, you know, that will make loads and loads of cash and people be dying for get my product. Where would you go? Would you go to like the weight loss Ozempic stuff? Would you go for like Viagra? Where do you think you'd go?
Yeah, I mean, I have a list of startups that I would like to do at some point, but we probably should do like a whole episode on that. Like, just go through a list.
Yeah, that sounds fun, actually.
Of health startups. Yeah, let's do that.
Adam's list.
Adam, can I ask you a question? Like, why do you think investors are interested in this space? Like, if you to put $50 million into a business like this, like, you have to feel pretty bullish on where this is going to go.
Well, I mean, first of all, it's a huge market, skincare. But there's also this...
How big is it?
Pharmaceuticals is a $45 billion market.
It's pretty big.
But the thing is, imagine an algorithm of different medications and different kind of indications for different prescription medications. This is only going to get more complex, and there are going to be more and more options available. So this is an ever-expanding market as well. Just as we started with the, you know, one product for hair loss, and now there's like a few... the same thing will happen with every health vertical. And not only that, if you have 100,000 people buying skincare products from you, these are 100,000 people that you have healthcare information on. These are 100,000 people that you can sell, you know, different healthcare products to as well. So it's quite valuable, and it's quite and it's an expanding market.
Yeah, let's say they switch on like Wegovy access next month, right? Then all of a sudden you've got like another line of revenue for those 100. And presumably, if you're 100,000 people paying, you know, just reading some of the Trustpilot reviews, people are talking about baskets of hundreds of pounds of goods that they're being you know, suggested to buy as their plan. So these are going to be people with like a lot of disposable income. Right, they're going to be people who have purchasing power,
who are interested in their health, interested in the way they look. So it can be a fantastic business.
What do you think are the risks of a business like this?
I think differentiation is going to be a problem because it's difficult to build a moat around this. So there will be other competitors. There are already competitors, but there's also a problem with the perception. It's really difficult to, this is the same in the kind of longevity sphere. it's really difficult for people to trust you and to actually trust that, because everyone has this facade of trust. Everyone can cite, trussted by doctors. Everyone can cite studies. Everyone can cite, can use these kind of trustworthy words. So people have kind of become immune to this kind of talk and to this kind of branding. So that's a big hurdle to climb over. There's also a problem with churn, I think. Most long-term health, like skincare issues, aren't treated by prescriptions. They're mostly like over-the-counter products.
Right? Yeah.
The basics of moisturizing, sunscreen, all of that. And you can get those products, fairly cheaply once you know what works for you. So yeah, the period is just kind of a discovery period with a clinician of what works for you. Then you learn about your own skin. You learn what works for you, and then you can continue that on your own.
Okay, let's finish off with some comments. So two bits of feedback. One from Jacob Robinson on YouTube saying, firmly invested in the future panel interview format. So he's keen for us to try the interview format that we talked, where we bring someone on and all three of us have a go interviewing them. So yeah, maybe we should do that. Worth trying. I personally don't think it'll work very well, but we can try.
Yeah. Yeah, I have mixed opinions on that.
Someone else will be the center of attention, Imran, but we will get through it.
Thanks, bro.
The other bit of feedback we got was, this one was quite funny. So this was from someone called Jotarmoy Banerjee, who commented on our last episode. And Adam, I think he's referring to you here. He says, longevity doctor on antibiotics is right about LLM models having unbelievably high number of parameters, and he sends his love from India. So he just refers to you as the longevity doctor on antibiotics.
I'm the longevity doctor on antibiotics. Love it.
Nice. All right, guys. I think we have some interesting stuff to discuss next time, but this one was good. Thanks.
All right.